Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find us online at thecommonwealthclub.org on Facebook and Twitter and on your YouTube channel. I am Richard Rubin, member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and your moderator for today. And now on to our subject, high-speed rail in California. The cost of statewide high-speed rail is estimated at $68 billion, with the Northern California pieces coming in at the $12 to $15 billion range. Currently, $3.3 billion of that is slated to come from federal funding and $9.5 billion from the state bond money. Where does all of this stand? Will the economics of high-speed rail come together and hold up? What will be the actual timeline? Will the majority of Californians benefit from this plan? And I'm sure you're going to be interested in all of those things. To address these questions, it is going to be my great pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speaker, Dan Richard, who's chair of the California High-Speed Rail Authority. A few words about Mr. Richard. He has had a distinguished career in both the public and the private sectors. He has been a principal of Dan Richard's advisors since 2010 and was the managing partner and co-founder of Heritage Oak Capital Partners, an infrastructure finance firm, from 2007 to 2009. Prior to that, he served for 9 years as the senior vice president for public policy and government relations at Pacific Gas and Electric. He was on the BART board for 12 years and served twice as its president. He was Governor Jerry Brown's deputy legal affairs secretary during the first administration and an advisor to the chairman of the California Energy Commission from 1982. Mr. Richard began his career at NASA. He received his Juris Doctorate after studying his undergraduate work at Washington University in St. Louis. He got his doctorate in law from the McGeorge School of Law, and he lives in Piedmont. Would you please welcome Dan Richard.
Thank you. Richard, thank you very much. It's a great honor to be here again at the Commonwealth Club of California. Thank you for inviting me back. Before I start, I'd just like to give a shout-out to my friend Rod Diridon, who introduced me last time I was here. Rod was a member of the High-Speed Rail Authority Board for many years and an early visionary on high-speed rail issues in California. He serves now as the director of the Mineta Transportation Institute in San Jose, and I send him my best wishes for speedy recovery. I am honored to not only be here, but also to have been appointed by Governor Jerry Brown to lead this very important effort in California. For those who may be listening from afar, Governor Brown returned to office as governor in 2010, having been one of the youngest governors in California history in the 1970s. And he came back to really address many issues that were facing our state, not the least of which was a budget crisis at that time. But beyond tackling those issues successfully, this governor, our governor in this state, has focused quite a bit on the kind of investments that we need to make to move the state forward into the future, and not just in transportation, but in energy and water. And he's a person who thinks about what we need to leave for the next generations, and that's a hallmark of this administration. Now, the subject of tonight's talk is the California High-Speed Rail Program, but it's going to take a little while before I actually get to talking about that, because it's very important to put this program in proper context. Often when I give speeches or have conversations with Californians, They say, well, why should we be pursuing high-speed rail? How is high-speed rail going to help us? What's important about high-speed rail? And I always respectfully suggest that that's the wrong starting point. Here's the right starting point. The right starting point is we as Californians and we as Americans have to look forward to a future of a changing economy and a changing state and a changing nation. In California, when I came to this state 36 years ago, there were 22 million people. Today there are 38 million people. Over the next 36 years, by the time we get to 2050, there will be more than 50 million people in California. And the demographers argue about whether or not the state of Ohio or the state of New York will effectively be picking up and moving to our state. So we will have a lot more people. And that means that we face challenges in terms of mobility, in terms of the environment, in terms of the sustainability of our cities and our environment. And the right place to start is to ask the question, how can we, of the current generation of Californians, make the kind of decisions that will shape the future of our state, or will we instead be shaped by it? And when we look at that, we're looking right now at a state that, on a standalone basis, is the eighth largest economy in the world. I suppose, depending on the stock market, we vary between eighth or ninth or whatever. We are, on a standalone basis, the 16th largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world. Where will we be in 2050? This state is already crowded. It's already congested. Our air corridor between Los Angeles and San Francisco is one of the busiest in the nation and has 40% of the flights between those two cities delayed because of weather and other problems. So we already face these challenges today with 38 million people. How will we address them with 50 million people? We believe that to meet the mobility needs that we could achieve with high-speed rail, by other means, we would need to build 2,300 new lane miles of freeways. We would need to build 5 new airport runways, airport terminals, just to handle the current levels of mobility that we're trying to deal with as the state grows. And as we look at those alternatives to a more modern transportation system, they would end up costing 2 to 3 times as much as we project our high-speed rail system is going to cost in California. Other challenges we face in this state are well known to people. There is a prodigious loss of farmland in the Central Valley. For those who are not familiar with California's great Central Valley, it's the home to many of America's specialty crops. It's one of the richest agricultural and most productive agricultural areas in the world. It is comprised of about 6 million acres of farmland. Projections are that by 2050, we could lose 10% of that, 600,000 acres, basically to development. And there's been a huge loss of farmland over the last 30 or 40 years. So how do we keep sprawl from gobbling up our farmland? How do we keep our cities vibrant and not become hollowed out? How do we deal with congestion, and how do we deal with its effects on public health? Right now in the Central Valley of California, 21% of the children have asthma. And that's the result of an environment where air is trapped between two mountain ranges, where the agricultural activities kick up a lot of dust. There's a lot of development down there for construction. How do we deal with these issues? Now, I'm not here to tell you that high-speed rail or any single initiative like that is going to solve those problems. The governor has a phrase that he used when he talks about some problems are actually conditions that we are going to have to deal with over the long term and learn how to adapt ourselves to them. But we can have an impact on our future instead of being shaped by it. Instead of more sprawl and pollution, we can have smart growth that actually revitalizes cities and accommodates the desires of population to have balance between where they live and where they work. Those cities with smart growth are more efficient to run. They cost the taxpayers less money for services, and they provide better coordination between transit and land use. We can have a state that has cleaner energy production and better transportation options. That's the context in which we ought to be having this conversation about high-speed rail. high-speed rail as one of the tools that we use to basically craft a better, more sustainable future for our state and for the nation. Now, as we look at the transportation piece of this future, we believe in California that rail and rail passenger rail systems are an increasingly vibrant and important part of the mix. Now notice, I'm still not talking about high-speed rail. The investments that we've made so far are really predicated on the notion that we need a widespread rail modernization system that includes urban systems like the BART system here in San Francisco, or our commuter train systems like Caltrain between San Francisco and San Jose, or the Los Angeles Metrolink system, and intercity lines that Amtrak runs, which are increasingly popular. You know, we're a car culture here in California. That's the common view of this state. And, you know, how many places in the world do they write songs about their cars? Whether it's the little deuce coupe or the little old lady from Pasadena, California has long been associated with cars and that part of human mobility. But in fact, Californians also love their trains. And I'll tell you something that surprises most people when they hear it. 3 out of the 5 busiest Amtrak routes in the United States are here in California. The busiest Amtrak route is the Acela service on the East Coast between Boston, New York, and Washington, D.C. But the second busiest line is the Surfliner that runs from Los Angeles to San Diego. And also we have trains between here in the Bay Area, San Jose and San Francisco, and our capital in Sacramento. And I will tell you that years ago when I worked on that, there were 4 trains a day running on that line carrying passengers. Today there are 30 trains a day. And the ridership is going up at double-digit rates. And we have service through the Great Central Valley from the Bay Area and Sacramento down to Bakersfield. And that's something you wouldn't think would get much train service. They have 1.3 million trips a year on that line. And I have been in the city of Fresno on a Sunday night getting off that train, and it's like Grand Central Station. So we have very vibrant ridership on our train systems in California. In the urban areas, whether it's BART, where the ridership projections are going through the roof, or Los Angeles, where you wouldn't think that subways are popular, and they have become incredibly popular, and these intercity rail services. What we've done with the high-speed rail program is to basically say it needs to be integrated into a whole statewide look at a transportation system that helps people avoid car trips and move by rail. And by the way, as we're looking at the investment in the future, one of the things to keep in mind is this is very generational. The younger generation in the last 10 years, the generation of the people under 35, have reduced their number of vehicle miles traveled by car by something like 25%. And they've increased the vehicle miles traveled by bus and rail by 40%. So the next generations are already moving in this direction of looking for alternatives to the type of transportation that many of us grew up with. We look at the high-speed rail investment as being part and parcel of this. And frankly, this is one of the changes and the most profound change that was brought to this program when Governor Brown came in and when he appointed his leadership team, is to stop looking at high-speed rail as just another standalone system and begin to see it as part of a network. The backbone, if you will, of a network that shares ridership with these urban and regional transportation systems, shares costs and planning, and so that this rising tide can lift all boats. These systems can work well together, delivering riders and improving efficiency and economics. And high-speed rail in California or anywhere makes more sense as part of an integrated overall system. So I spent a number of moments here talking about the context, both the future of California and also the future of rail transportation in California. So what is it we're actually talking about with our high-speed rail program? What is it and where is it going? Well, high-speed rail in California was an idea that began many years ago. When I was working for Governor Brown the first time when I came out here, he signed one of the early pieces of legislation to start planning for high-speed rail in California. And planning went on for some time, but 2008 was really the pivotal year for the program. because two things happened in that year. The first was that the people of California enacted a bond measure of $9 billion, almost $10 billion, actually, to start the construction of a high-speed rail system in California. And at the same time, President Obama was elected in November of that year, and no one knew it at the time, but he came in and proposed a stimulus bill to get the economy moving again. And a lot of people don't realize that in the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act, the Stimulus Act, $8 billion was provided for high-speed rail around the United States. We in California, I think because of the planning we had done, because of the work we had done, and the vision of our leaders in our legislature and in our administration, were able to quickly go out and we grabbed the lion's share of that. $3.3 billion of federal money is coming to us to combine with our bond dollars to build the high-speed rail system. What is it we're building? Well, what the bond measure said and what the people voted for was this: a modern, fast, clean electric train system that would connect all the major population centers of our state. The first phase is to go from the Los Angeles and Anaheim area in the south all the way up through our Central Valley into San Francisco, into downtown San Francisco. And that will be about 520 miles of track, virtually all of it new. Some of it, as we come into the urban areas, we've decided we can share our track with existing rail that's there to keep the cost down. I said it would be electric, and I said it would be fast. The bond measure says it must be designed to achieve sustained speeds in excess of 200 miles an hour. That will make our system one of the fastest high-speed rail systems in the world. And the bond measure also said that it must be designed to convey a rider from Los Angeles to San Francisco, or the other way, in under 2 hours and 40 minutes. And it made it very clear that what the people wanted was true high-speed rail and not to have the money spent on something that was not going to achieve those objectives. The other thing that we deal with, and that is a challenge for us, is that the law requires that this system must operate without an operating subsidy. And this is a very important point that many people don't understand, because most of us, myself included, started with the preconceived notion that all of our transit systems in America are subsidized, that in fact the public is paying to cover some of the operating costs of our transportation systems. And this is true of our systems like BART here, or the metro system in Washington, D.C., or subways or commuter trains around the country. But it is not true of high-speed rail. It's not true of high-speed rail any place in the world that high-speed rail has been built. The experience around the world, because high-speed trains are competing against airlines, is that once the initial capital investment has been made with public dollars, that the systems sustain themselves, that they throw off more operating cash than it takes to run them, once the initial capital investment's been made. A couple of the systems, like the Paris to Lyon system on the TGV in France, have started paying back some of their initial capital. But in general, you make the investment, and these systems do not require an ongoing subsidy. And our estimates of our system is that that will be true here as well. In fact, when we look at the projected revenues from the ridership that we would carry, even using what I consider to be very conservative numbers, the current value of that is about $20 billion. That's $20 billion of money that would be generated that will help us build the rest of the system. That's close to a third of the system cost right there, which would be generated from system operations. So we don't have all the answers, and I know some of the questions will go to where the money is coming from, and we'll talk about that. But actually, this system makes sense from an economic and business standpoint as an investment in the state's transportation future. We're starting our system in the middle, and this has been kind of controversial. A lot of people have asked, why are you starting in the Central Valley of California? And I will tell you, as a Californian who's been here for 36 years, I had not spent much time in the Central Valley. The Central Valley is somewhat isolated from the rest of the state. In fact, it's long car trip to get there. There's very little airline service that connects our Central Valley with either San Francisco or Los Angeles. And some questioned why we would start in the middle. I was one of those people before I came on this board and had a chance to look at the issues. But it actually makes a lot of sense. It's the spine of the system. And with the dollars we have, it's a flat area. We can build more track mile for each dollar that we have than any place else. And so we can lay down a bunch of track. It's the fastest growing area of our state. The Central Valley of California, which was once described by a member of Congress as having more cows than people, is not that at all. It is 4.2 million people that, if it were its own state, would rank 26th, bigger than the state of Connecticut in terms of population. There are a lot of people there, and the growth rate is 9% a year. One of the things that I've learned in the years that I've worked on transportation projects is the most important thing you can do as a first step is to secure right-of-way. Because when you don't secure right-of-way, what you find is that coming back to get it later, it's going to be more difficult, it's going to cost more money, it's going to be harder to acquire. And so we have no right-of-way for a standalone passenger rail system in the Central Valley. There's a line down there now that is shared with freight. But if we need to have that right-of-way, this is the time to get it. One other thing. In the Central Valley of California, we have the opportunity to test the trains. I said the trains are going to run at 200-mile-an-hour speeds. We're going to test them at 250 miles an hour. You can't really do that between Los Angeles and Anaheim or any of the number of other segments that we're going to be ultimately serving. And there's another reason that we're starting there, too, which is, unfortunately, this is a part of our state that's really been left behind economically. The Central Valley, despite the tremendous wealth of the agricultural production there, is actually the poorest part of our state. It's got terribly high poverty levels. The unemployment rate there is twice the state average. Unemployment among construction trades in the Central Valley is in excess of 30%. So making a public investment in that part of the state that's been left behind makes good sense. From the Central Valley, our plan is to build south towards Los Angeles. And that will mean that we will end up having to traverse the Tehachapi Mountain Range. For those of you who may be from outside of California or listening, you may not have heard of the Tehachapi Mountains, but they're taller than many of the mountains back east, and they separate the Los Angeles and Southland area of our state from the northern part of our state. And that will be a very important engineering challenge that we have to meet, but we will meet it. Just as prior generations pumped water over the Tehachapis to bring water from Northern California to Southern California, we can put a rail line over there. We will begin construction this year. We are already in the construction phase. We have awarded our first contract, and I'm happy to say that that contractor came in with estimates that were about 40% below what our guesses were as to what the price would be. So that was welcome news. That contractor is now ensconced in Fresno. They're hiring people. They're doing the soils testing. They're finishing the design of the system. And to use a phrase that our friend Nancy Pelosi likes to use, we expect dirt to fly here within the next couple of months. Now, I've been talking about all this, and I'm sure some of you are thinking, well, wait a minute. I've heard that there's all this controversy with high-speed rail. I've heard that there are lawsuits. I've heard that there is political opposition. I don't mean to diminish that, and I'll be happy to talk about it. But again, I want to put things in context. We sit here tonight in San Francisco, where the most iconic structure in this city and perhaps in this state is the Golden Gate Bridge. There were 2,300 lawsuits aimed at stopping the construction of the Golden Gate Bridge. No less than Ansel Adams described the design of the bridge as an upside-down rat trap that would mar the natural beauty of the Golden Gate. And as much as I revere his work, I would respectfully suggest that that might not have been his most accurate prediction. So all of these things, and I've been privileged in my life to have a chance to work on some of these, whether it's extension of regional transit systems or trying to build energy projects, they're always complicated. They're always controversial. There are always questions about whether or not it can be done. There are always challenges, lawsuits, and attack. It's part and parcel of what this means. But I stand here tonight highly confident that we will be able to prevail over these and that they're just a normal part of the process. I mentioned that we can generate more dollars than it costs to operate the system. Because of that, there is very strong private sector interest in this project. Funding is always a question, but we have the opportunity that most transportation projects don't to have the private sector deeply involved in not only the construction but also the operation of the system. In addition to that, our governor and now our legislative leaders this week have talked about tapping a new funding source. And this is the money from the Greenhouse Gas Emission Control Program under something called the cap and trade, where you cap the emissions and trade the emission credits. And that has the potential to generate billions of dollars of revenues, which by law are supposed to be used to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. A modern electric train system that will anchor downtown developments to revitalize cities is very well suited to tapping into those dollars because of the benefits we provide for greenhouse gas protection. So I just want to also point out that while these things are very difficult, in this year, it's now the 50th year since the nation of Japan opened their bullet train, the Shinkansen, between Tokyo and Osaka, a half century ago. They have never stopped building. They have extended it to more cities, to more towns, to smaller towns. And they have just continued to expand and build this over 2.5 generations. And I believe this is the story that we're going to tell here in California as we move through this century. So let me just end at this point with this, because I'd really like to engage in a conversation with you and take your questions. I believe, and I'm privileged to work for a leader of our state, the governor, who believes that we have an absolute obligation to future generations to make investments to leave our state better than we found it. I mentioned that I came here 36 years ago. At that time, we were still living off of the investments made by this governor's father, Governor Edmund G. Pat Brown, who was governor from the late 1950s into the 60s. He helped build our highway system. He helped build our university system. He helped build our water system. And he did all those things to prepare a state for the future. Today, in 2014, unfortunately, we are still living off of those infrastructure investments. We really haven't done much beyond that. And it's time for us to make those hard choices, to decide what kind of future we're going to have as a state, and to make the investments in things that we know will be both clean and sustainable, but improve the quality of life for our citizens. I believe that we will build high-speed rail in California. I believe we will inspire the rest of the nation to follow suit. And I think that that will be an important step for America as we move through the 21st century. And with that, I'm happy to have a conversation with you and take your questions. Thank you again for inviting me to be here tonight.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dan, for those remarks. You've covered a lot of territory, but now it's time for our audience to put their questions to you and get some answers. We're not going to be able to answer all of them. There have been many given to me, but we'll do as best we can. And I'm going to try to incorporate a few of them into one or two questions so that they're consolidated. You know, all large projects, as you're well aware, start with issues about costs and benefits. And this one's no different, obviously. Typically, the costs go up and the benefits have their skeptics. And I think you're facing that situation now. We think of such things as BART, that you're very familiar with, which started out as a costly enterprise, and today few would argue that it has not proven to be a very valuable asset in the Bay Area and to the transit mix. So we move on from there. In the revised business plan, which your board submitted last week, it was reported that revenue is expected to be 5% lower than originally projected by 2025 and 10% lower by 2040. That was reported in the papers. Mm-hmm. But that you would still be able to operate without taxpayer subsidies, and furthermore, you don't expect delays. Is it likely that we will be able to continue to see what you're hoping to do now without many more revised projections, or do you anticipate that's likely to be the future?
A couple of things on this. First of all, I'd like to point out that just all of us, just as a matter of common sense, I'm sure view these kinds of projections with skepticism, because we've all read stories about projects that have gotten out of control. We have a Bay Bridge here that costs much more than people anticipated, and that is the general rule in large infrastructure projects. However, I'd like to make a couple of key points. First of all, we're using a technique that is called the design-build approach. Most of you are familiar with the fact that organizations go out and they hire somebody to design something, then they hire a different person to go build it. And frankly, whether this is remodeling your kitchen, where the contractor is using the architect's plans and then comes and tells you that the architect didn't know what he or she was doing and they have to make these changes, and that's why you're going to have to get your checkbook out, or whether it's a major infrastructure project, people are always looking at these kinds of change orders. Well, a design-build approach says that what we're doing is we're designing about 30% of it, and then the contractor team finishes the design and builds to that design. And we used this technique when I was at BART. And frankly, we were able to bring in the BART San Francisco Airport extension within the budget that we had once we started building. We brought a couple of BART extensions in below the estimates. So it's a very effective technique, and we have a lot of confidence in it. I will also tell you that some of our critics in Congress asked the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, to come in and do a deep dive into our projections of ridership and revenue and costs. And I think to the chagrin of some of the people who thought that they would strike gold in terms of their opposition to the project, the GAO came back and said, looking at the way the High Speed Rail Authority has done this, we find that their revenue projections are prudent. We find that their cost projections in terms of their capital costs fit within our guidelines of how this should be done. Does that mean we won't have problems? No. But I think we've taken a very careful approach to it. And let me just say one thing about the ridership numbers. Years ago, the High Speed Rail Authority put out one ridership number. This is before I was there. And it was widely attacked, and it was thought to be pretty flaky, actually. One of the other people that the governor appointed along with me was a fellow named Mike Rossi, who was the former vice chairman of Bank of America. So he brought a banker's eye and a real knowledge of these kinds of systems and models to this. And we scrubbed down all our numbers. The result of scrubbing down our numbers is we became more conservative in our numbers, which I think is appropriate for a project like this. Between 2012 and 2014, what we said is we're going to continue to refine our ridership projections. And the reason that these numbers came down is that what we said was, you know, we think as we get more sophisticated with our models, there are going to be more trips of short duration. And because there are more trips of short duration, they'll have less revenues, but they'll also have some correspondingly lower costs. So what I would tell you is we're going to continue to refine our numbers, and we're going to continue to take a pretty conservative approach to the numbers. The most important thing is to be able to look the people in the eye and say, we're convinced that if we make this investment, we will be able to cover our operating costs. And we are very clearly in that range.
Well, and I guess, you know, some people are thinking about the fact that when this was introduced to the voters in 2008, and they passed 1A, we saw a budget figure coming in around $10 billion. It's now gone to an eye-popping $68 billion. That's the cost that we're hearing, or the price we're hearing. So obviously there's going to be people who are looking at that and saying that's a lot of money. But let me move a little bit beyond that. Others would say, and there's a question from one person in the audience saying, you know, we have a lot of priorities in California. Is this really the highest priority we have, or one of them? We have drought management issues. We have climate control issues. We have pension funds that are not unfunded, et cetera, et cetera. Dan, how do you rank this among the priorities that the state should be looking at?
Well, I have the luxury that since I'm not in elected office, I don't have to rank them. I mean, that is the job of our legislature and our governor. And all of those things that you talked about are very important. And I can't sit here and tell you that high-speed rail is more important than an investment in the University of California system or in fixing the pension crisis. What I can tell you, though, is that when you're looking at parts of the state that have been left behind, where people are not contributing to the state's economy but forced to lean against the social safety net, these kinds of investments are generally viewed as generating 3 to 4 times the amount of tax revenues that compared to the expenditure that you're making. So there will be an effect of making this investment that is going to help the general tax revenue situation in the state. I just want to make one other point, too. Yesterday was the 150th anniversary of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. When President Lincoln was in office in 1862, before Antietam, before he even knew that the Union had a chance of winning, at probably the darkest days in the history of this country, he signed the Trans-Pacific Railroad Act to build the National Pacific Railroad. They also signed the Morrill Act to create the state land-grant colleges in the middle of the Civil War. At some point, you have to look ahead, and I often wonder, when did we lose confidence in our ability to solve these problems? And I think the problems you laid out are ones that it's our responsibility to solve. My job is to try to help make sure that we have a transportation system in the future that works, but it's part of many of the problems we have to solve. But there's never a good time to do it. I think the time to do it is when it needs to be done, and that's right now.
Let's talk a little bit about the people this is going to serve mostly. You know, we have, of course, airplanes. We have buses. They go to places pretty fast, airplanes particularly. Some would even argue that they do so more cheaply. Still, others would contend that we're building a system that's going to mainly serve riders with high income, but what about those folks who are not going to be able to afford the price of getting on those trains? Is this going to be a mode of transportation that's going to be an alternative to those looking for that kind of operation? And furthermore, and this is a question that came from the audience, is this going to be more serviceable for short-term commuter runs, or are we looking at this as something that's going to help us for the long runs that are contemplated?
Taking the last question first, we see a system that's going to accomplish both of those things, that it will connect a number of short city pairs, but it also will connect long-distance cities across long distances. Let me talk about the issue of the equity of who's going to ride this. And this is a very important point. Last year I had the privilege of accompanying the governor to China on a trade mission to China. And there we were on a high-speed rail train. China, by the way, has built 9,000 kilometers, more than 5,000 miles of high-speed rail line. And we were sitting on this train, and I was talking to some of the reporters, and we were zooming through the countryside. It's 5 hours by high-speed rail at almost 200 miles an hour between Beijing and Shanghai. And so the reporters had a lot of time on their hands. So finally, one of them got around to the question of, well, who's riding this? We're sitting up here in business class. Who's riding this? And I said, why don't you walk back about 3 cars? Because what you will see is middle-class and working-class Chinese on 3x3 seats in those cars on this same train. And the reporter came back and said, my, that was really impressive to see that. And I understand the same thing is true in Japan. Many working people use these trains to get from where they live to where they work or from one job site to the other. Our projections are based on the notion that we have to beat the airline short-haul fare. So if high-speed rail were running right now in California, our pricing would be that you could go from Los Angeles to San Francisco at about 85% of a short-haul Southwest ticket, or $83. I think that's going to be very accessible to the entire range of California citizens.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California program. We're talking with Dan Richard, who's chair of the California High-Speed Rail Authority. I'm Richard Rubin, your moderator. And you can hear Commonwealth Club programs on radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on your YouTube channel. Dan, let me ask you this question. We are still hearing, and I know politics has to rear its ugly head at some point in these conversations, so why don't we bring it up now? We're continuing to hear loud opposition coming from some quarters. For example, U.S. Representative Kevin McCarthy, who is from California, from Bakersfield. He's the third-ranking Republican member of the House. And he's on record saying as follows, and I'm quoting him, "We have no private funds, we have unreliable ridership numbers, and the reliance on taxpayers to eventually bail out the project. And he vows, with others, to continue to deny federal funding to the project." Is this project one that could be derailed if there's going to be that kind of opposition coming out of Congress, or can you overcome those issues and move forward?
Well, first, let me just say for the record that with all due respect to the House Majority Leader, those statements that he made are not factually correct. Second, I've been through this before. When I was a member of the BART Board in 1994, the Republicans took both the House and the Senate, and we were told that there would be no funding for BART San Francisco Airport, where we were counting on $750 million of federal money. And yet we ended up with $750 million of federal money. It is an unfortunate reality that transportation has been infected by the same partisanship that unfortunately has pervaded other parts of our polity. And this was never the case. It was never the case. As somebody said, there are no Democratic or Republican potholes. And yet we find that today, if the president proposes something or if the governor proposes something, it may ignite a partisan response to it. And some of the folks who are taking the positions that they're taking today actually voted for high-speed rail when they were in the California legislature, and they are doing a fairly good imitation of a pretzel to try to contort themselves into a position that now opposes it. So I take this with a grain of salt. I've been around politics enough to know that some of these are the result of short-term political realities. Here's the real reality. Despite the fact that you'll pick up the paper and you might see statements like public support is diminishing, the Public Policy Institute of California, one of our most respected public opinion organizations, just came out with a new poll. They asked the same question about high-speed rail. Strangely enough, I think in their mind, support for this project, despite the controversy of the last couple of years, litigation and statements like the one you heard, support has actually been rising. We had 52% of all Californians saying they supported the project, but the more important number was this. They've asked the same question 3 years in a row. Do you feel that high-speed rail is either very important or somewhat important to the state's future? Californians responded in the affirmative over 60%, approaching two-thirds. So there's a lot of noise, there's a lot of pushback, but we're moving forward because it's the right thing to do for this state.
Let's just continue our focus on Washington, D.C. for the moment. The Obama administration approved matching grants for this project. I think you mentioned that earlier as part of the 2009-10 stimulus package. Right. As I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, these funds are set to expire in 2017. What happens after that? Are we going to be looking mainly to the private sector to raise the additional money? Or are we going to have to go back and look with an expectation that the government's going to have to put in some more dough to make this happen? Where do we go with this?
Well, first of all, the most of the $3.3 billion, not all of it comes from the Stimulus Act, but the amount that does come from the Stimulus Act does need to be spent by 2017. Now, it's not an on-off switch. If we spend all but $10 of it, we lose that $10. We don't lose the entire amount. So one of the reasons why we're trying to push forward in the face of some of these challenges is so that we don't end up leaving any of that money on the table. And I think we're in pretty good shape for that right now. Beyond that, though, I mentioned the cap-and-trade dollars. This could be a significant amount of money. And not only that, but it has another value as well. If our legislature does enact a program that allows us to have a multi-year revenue source, we can then use that to finance part of the construction, either through the sale of revenue bonds or something else. And what that means is we can start building pieces in parallel. We could start building from two different directions at once. And what that means is that we would save billions of dollars. Because the reason this program is so expensive is that our projections conservatively, I might add, include a 3% embedded inflation expectation. So if we take years off the project, we save money. If you want us to reduce the cost of high-speed rail, help us build it faster. And that's what these revenue sources will do. And once they come in, I think that will then trigger the private sector. And private sector representatives already stood up and said that with the cap and trade dollars, it really accelerates their interest in getting involved in the program earlier. So we feel very good about that direction.
Okay. Well, since we're giving politicians on all sides equal time, and we are a nonpartisan organization, Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom actually addressed this group not too long ago. Of course, he's a leading Democrat and was an early supporter of high-speed rail. And apparently he was on Seattle radio program recently and said that he no longer backed the bullet train and would prefer to see the funds used for other projects. From what you know, Dan, is it possible that he and the governor might get together, have a little discussion, and he might get back on the train, or what do you see?
Well, the first words that came into my head is, Mama didn't raise a fool, so I don't think I'm really going to comment on that one. but I would just say this. I respect the lieutenant governor. I know him. I think that, we have had our ups and downs, as any of these projects do, and sometimes when things are looking a little dark, it's easy for people to decide that maybe a different direction is right, and I respect if that's where he wants to go. But here's what I think is more important. We have the sustained support of not only the president and our governor, the vice president is, of course, the nation's number one rail advocate, but more importantly, our congressional delegation, Senators Feinstein and Boxer, and the thing that I think is most significant is we have bipartisan support from the mayors of all our major cities in California. Mayor Ashley Swearingen of Fresno, a Republican, sees high-speed rail as a tool to revitalize her city. Mayor Jim Ledford of Palmdale, a Republican, believes the same thing. They are very vocal high-speed rail supporters. The mayors of San Francisco, San Jose, Sacramento, Los Angeles, all have been persistent supporters of high-speed rail because the mayors see the impact on their cities, on the ground. And we're very gratified to have that level of support, including support from all the major business organizations in the state. So it's never going to be unanimous. I actually think we're doing very well.
Well, fair enough. You make some very good points here in discussing the fact that there's input coming from local officials. Following up on that, is there room, and can you tell us how the public can actually make direct inputs in this process as you've gone through it, going from community to community? Obviously, people have very strong opinions, as they do in this room and elsewhere. How is that being demonstrated, that you're showing them an ability to participate in the process?
You know, I'm very proud of the work we've done at the High Speed Rail Authority. There's a lot of stuff that I describe as under the hood that I think is important in terms of how a government agency operates. And we've put in place, for example, at our board level, some very, very strong governance guidelines. We have, on our website, you'll be able to see as we move into construction in real time where we are in terms of the expenditure of public dollars, how we're looking at various risk factors. These are things that generally you don't see from government organizations. And I'm equally proud of the fact that I think we've gone to great lengths to reach out to the public and to have public input. When we put our business plans together, we've had public hearings. People are able to comment not only by appearing before our board, but through email and website traffic. We reach out to these communities. I have spent a great deal of time right in the center of opposition to high-speed rail in Kings County in the Central Valley, where the first thing they did was take me out to the monument commemorating the gunfight between the railroad guys and the sheriffs in the 1800s. That was an interesting day, but I sat down with them and talked with folks. I've appeared before the county supervisors in those counties, and I think we have really done everything that you would want a government agency to do to make sure that all voices are heard and to be respectful of those who have a different opinion. And frankly, we have changed our plans in response to public input and criticism, especially here in the San Francisco Bay Area, where it was the public and some other legislators who said we should try to use existing infrastructure as much as possible. That was not in high-speed rail's plans, and we embraced that. So I think we've been very open. We have a website that I think is quite user-friendly, and I encourage everybody to go look at what we're doing.
Now, earlier you talked a little bit about the fact that, and everyone I know appreciates this, that there's going to be potential environmental impacts as this goes forward. But it would seem to be, if you're trying to make the point that you're going to reduce the carbon footprint rather than increase it through this process, shouldn't the environmentalists be getting behind this? And if so, are they getting behind it? And if not, why aren't they?
A number of the environmental organizations have been very supportive of high-speed rail. And I think as the project changed and as we moved it in the direction of really trying to make sure that we supported and integrated with these urban and regional systems, that garnered even more support. It's not been universal. Not everybody has been on board, but a number of the key environmental organizations have been. And in particular, that segment of the environmental community that focuses on the smart growth and coordination of transit and land use. They have been very excited about high-speed rail and the tool that high-speed rail could be for revitalizing these cities. I will also tell you that as we build this system, we're quite cognizant of the fact that we don't want to be creating more emissions in the short term only to try to mitigate them in the long term. We have demanded that the contractor use the most advanced equipment possible. We are planting trees, we're offsetting our carbon emissions and other emissions and doing all these things as we build. So we're looking at this process in every way that we can to make sure that it achieves the promise of a better and more sustainable future for California.
And so in that connection, as this goes forward, are you anticipating you're going to have to see a lot of EIRs, environmental impact reports, coming out of each community and ad seriatim as we go through this process? Is this something that we're going to have to expect to happen? And is that going to delay in any way the timetable that's been established?
Well, the answer is yes. As we go through the process, we have to do a full environmental analysis of every segment that we would build. It is possible for people not only to participate in that, but to challenge the results if they don't like them. People who oppose the project for whatever reason have done that. We have been sent back to the drawing board to redo environmental work. I'm happy to say most of that occurred before our present team was there. I think we've got very, very strong environmental analysis that we have. It's just part of what it takes to build things in this country. You know, I talked about in China that they built 5,000 miles of high-speed rail. And much of it they built in a very short time frame. I think they built the Beijing to Shanghai line in 4 years. We would be lucky to be through the environmental process in that period of time. But we're in California. We're not going to bulldoze people out of the way. We have to balance important public policy imperatives and the imperative of making sure that we fully examine the short and long-term environmental impacts of this project is something that's just the reality of building it, and our job is to complete those as quickly and as thoroughly as we can.
Further on the subject of potential delays, and obviously every big project has that potential problem, a Sacramento Superior Court judge, I think it was last December, denied your request to issue a blanket validation for the sale of, $10 billion in bonds, right, which was approved by Proposition 1A by the voters. For this high-speed rail authority and to build it, did that or will it affect your timetable? And are we looking at a situation where we're going to get tied up in litigation for many years to come, or do you foresee this as something that you're going to be able to work through and it won't happen?
Judge Michael Kenney, Superior Court Judge in Sacramento, did issue rulings starting in August and then completed in late November. That were adverse to our ability to access the state bonds. We disagree with those rulings and actually appealed them first to the state Supreme Court, which assigned them to an appellate court. We were very gratified by that. And with all due respect to the judge, we think the rulings were wrong. The governor, the state treasurer, the state controller, the head of the state secretary of transportation, all signed on to that appeal. And I'm very gratified that the Court of Appeals has now received friend of the court briefs from all the transportation agencies in the Bay Area, all the transportation agencies in Southern California, all of whom said that the judge's rulings were not correct and were problematic for any public agency to issue bonds. So this is why we have courts of appeal in this country, and I can't predict the outcome, but I think we're in a very strong position. Are we going to have further litigation? Certainly. But as I like to say, you know, if the Golden Gate Bridge had 2,300 lawsuits, right now we've got three or four, so we're doing a lot better than those guys were.
So as we're looking ahead for what we can expect here, what would be, in your opinion, the several reasons, or perhaps more than several, that has resulted in the resistance you're hearing from people who have raised issues and are skeptical that this is going to produce the benefits as you describe them? Is it perhaps that this is not being marketed properly to the public, or what is it we're looking at here that could make this a more saleable project, realizing you're always going to have people who are not going to agree with it?
A lot of the opposition we have are from people who are directly affected by the project coming through their farms or their communities, and I understand that. If it were coming through my community, I might well feel exactly the same way. So I do understand that. Have we marketed this well? Probably not. I think that there are oftentimes when I talk about high-speed rail, people come up to me afterwards and say, boy, I didn't realize this, or I didn't understand that about the state. And so shame on us, because that means that we're not reaching out effectively to folks. But I do want to make this one point. It's been a privilege for me to get this assignment from the governor for a lot of reasons, but one of them is, as a person who's lived in this state now, considers himself a Californian, this is a huge state, and it's really hard to understand the complexity of this state. And working on this project's given me a chance to visit every corner of the state. And one of the things that I've come to realize, you know, we sit here tonight, the San Francisco Giants are playing the Los Angeles Dodgers. Everybody thinks that's the big rivalry, North and South.
Go Giants.
But the real fact of the matter is that what I've learned is that this state is not really divided North and South. Not really. This state is really divided between our coastal areas and our inland areas. On the coasts, we have more wealth, better environment, most of the educational institutions, much more job opportunity. The Central Valley and the area east of L.A., they're being left behind. We've got a guy who wants to put a measure on the ballot to split California into six states. If he did, the state of Central California would replace Mississippi as the poorest state in the United States, which is shocking when you think of the agricultural production there and the wealth. We can't leave parts of the state behind. The idea here, and this is the thing that I think is most important about what we're doing, is to connect our state. That's what transportation does. It gives a chance for people, for goods, for businesses to communicate over long distances and to move to places where they want to be. And I think that that's one of the hidden benefits of this program and one of the things that's going to become apparent in years to come. And I'll just end with this. When Governor Pat Brown had the state water project, which was highly controversial, passed by the California legislature by one vote, which was our margin in the California legislature, he brought in all his supporters, he had a toast among them, and he said, now we are truly one California. That's what we're going to achieve with California High-Speed Rail.
Okay. One person in the audience asks this question. Will the workers involved in this project be union, non-union? Will they be allowed to strike? How are you going to deal with that issue?
So the construction workers, just by the nature of the fact that the five international consortia who were pre-qualified to bid all have pre-existing relationships with labor unions, then it's assured that the construction workers will be union. But the operation of this system is actually going to be by the private sector. We are going to auction off the rights for private operators to come in. This is what they've done in Japan and other places. How they handle the operating employees is a question yet to be determined. Having been on the BART board, having lived through one BART strike, seen some others, I certainly hope that we don't have to go down that road. But That's a matter for the labor relations folks in the future, but it'll be built by construction workers, and the operation is yet to be determined.
Now, you mentioned a long time ago in this conversation, Dan, that initially this was going to be a route that went from San Francisco down to Los Angeles, and now it's been changed somewhat, and it's going to go through Central Valley. You have a different routing that has been created. What were the reasons for that change? Why did that take place?
Well, actually, let me be clear on this. The bond measure and the people who authored and promoted the bond measure made it very clear that they wanted, and the law requires, that the route connect major cities in California. So a lot of times people say, well, why don't you just do the straight shot between San Francisco and Los Angeles? Because that doesn't connect the entire state. And so that's why the route comes from Los Angeles, goes east through Palmdale and Bakersfield and Fresno, and then turns west again to come through Gilroy and up through San Jose and up to San Francisco. That is a way that we can have more connections between these cities in our state. And that was designed into the system by law. The changes that we've made are that for 90% of what we build, it's going to be brand new track. But for about 10%, as we come into the city areas, we're going to use existing track. And we've decided we can do that and still meet the requirements for time and the other requirements of the Bond Act. That's really the change that we made, and that change saves billions of dollars.
So you're saying that existing commuter rail will, in parts of this, be integrated with the high-speed rail system? Is that what's going to happen?
That's right. So here in the peninsula, between San Francisco and San Jose, there's a very popular service called Caltrain, and it operates with diesel locomotives right now. The system is widely ridden, and we decided that instead of building new tracks parallel to that, we could use that track structure. But here's the great thing. We worked out an agreement with Caltrain where we're going to make an early investment right now to electrify that line, to replace the diesel trains with electric trains for the Caltrain commuter line. That brings immediate benefits in terms of speed, safety, and certainly cleanliness and the environmental quality. But we will end up using that corridor because we are running electric trains. We need to have that electric system there. So we're making that investment now to help that commuter system today, and it lays the groundwork for high-speed rail to come up that corridor in the future.
Well, thank you. Well, unfortunately, we have just about reached that point in our program where we're going to have to ask a final question of you. And let me just preface it by saying that we want to thank you for coming here today and doing this with us. This is obviously an extremely big challenge. In fact, it's one of the largest public works projects ever undertaken in the history of the state, not simply in the context of rail, but in the things the state has ever tried to do. So given all the obstacles that we've talked about, Dan, what needs to happen in your mind to make this a reality? What would you like to see in place that's going to enable us to get to the end of the line here, if that's the way to put it, and make people proud of the fact that California made this investment? How do we get there?
Well, first and foremost, we need the sustained involvement of political leaders. I mean, without question, if Governor Jerry Brown, when he came in 2010, if he had not embraced this project, I would not be sitting here tonight, at least not talking about high-speed rail. And our U.S. senators, Senator Feinstein and Senator Boxer, have beaten back efforts in the Congress when it has become more partisan. We need the sustained political leadership of the state. Nothing gets done without leadership. Beyond that, it's really going to be about trying to get to a stable funding source for this project. A stable funding source not only allows us to finance the project and accelerate construction, but it also advances the private sector's interest in getting involved. Those two things will be the key to getting high-speed rail done.
Thank you very, very much. We want to thank Dan Richard for this. He's chair of the California High-Speed Rail Authority. I want to thank our audience here and on radio, television, and in the Internet. I'm Richard Rubin. I am now going to declare this meeting of the Commonwealth Club to be at a close. This is the place where you come to be in the know, and I will hereby adjourn this meeting.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.